It'll be down to 5. It's okay. Right, right.
So what is it?
Sam. Is, what's his name still here? No.
Andrew. Where he is tonight, I'm not sure. Where he is tonight, I'm not sure.
I'll just say that.
Okay. Did somebody yell down, like, throughout the house that you were starting? Can we do that?
I'm gonna do that, Justin. Can you press the recording device and then turn it off when you're done?
You guys, why don't you guys slide down? Because as people come, everybody slide down this way as much as possible. And as people come in late, they'll come in back. Gentlemen, first of all, a tremendously heartfelt thanks to Rabbi Lopiansky, who is here. This is, I think, the third time Rabbi Lopiansky has come to visit the yeshiva. It's really l'shem shemayim when you come here because we're not the greatest recruiting ground for Lopiansky's yeshiva, but it is a big honor that Rabbi Lopiansky gives his time to come here and to answer your questions. In the past, Rabbi Lopiansky has given shiurim here. And we asked him this year if we could just prepare questions, and he has not been apprised of any of the contents of those questions. I've taken them in with pure subjectivity. I have organized them the way I wanted to. And without further ado, by the way, there were 40 questions, really amazing questions. We will deal with, hopefully, all of these questions over the course of the next month, couple months. There are other Rebbeim here who hopefully will be able to deal with some of these. But let's get started as soon as possible. Here, if I miss your questions, no offense.
No, just one comment. He said it's not a good place for recruiting, but we had one Talmud by us for the summer. And what was lacking in quantity was in quality. It was very, very enjoyable. And, Baruch Hashem.
And we've had two students who actually learned in yeshiva for some periods of time.
Yes,
also, right?
So Baruch Hashem. It's, we've.
Okay. Question number one. Is Judaism experience-based or intellectually based? If it's experience-based, what experience exactly are we waiting for? If it's intellectually based, how many questions do we need to ask and have answered before we are expected to accept? And especially given the fact that our teachers have amassed answers to more questions than we can even ask.
Well, you've just done a good job amassing questions, so I guess we... Now, do you mean based on what are we supposed to base it on?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I guess just as a person has a lot of different faculties... For instance, if I were to ask you how many points they need in common to make a marriage work, appropriate, etc., there wouldn't be a hard and fast answer, but it certainly wouldn't be any one thing to exclude the other. If somebody tells me, this girl is everything I want on paper, I says, so what's the problem? Well, I wish she was on paper because I don't like her. That's not a very, very... It's not going to make a good marriage. On the other hand, if somebody is crazy, he's got some infatuation with a person, and it doesn't make any sense, then people would be wise to tell him, wake up. For whatever reason, you've got some crazy liking for her, but it's absolutely senseless. So we're not going to have that... either or answer. When we want to, I have a neighbor of mine who's, guess what, a lawyer, as everybody else in Washington is, and he was a partner in a firm, and he was interviewing someone, and he t- told the other partner, he's kind of young, he said, you know, he's got everything we want, but interviewing him, I just don't like the guy. There's something about him I just don't like. He said, well, that's the purpose of an interview. A complete picture is, it has to make sense. It has to pass a certain sense, even if it makes sense logically, A, B, C, D, and E, but there's a certain sense of reasonableness, there's a certain sense of personal comfort or discomfort, and all of those things need to fall into place for a person to make a reasonable reasonable commitment. At the end of the day, if we should have committed and we didn't, only HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one that knows that we are fooling ourselves, and the reason we didn't commit was not because we weren't convinced. So it's going to, A, it's going to be a composite of it makes sense. It has a sort of, let's see if we can categorize areas of what, if I needed to make a decision about marriage, appropriate yeshiva, appropriate society, and so on, A, it would have to make sense. I might not be able to prove it intellectually. It has to make sense. I would like that there is a narrative which claims to be direct as opposed to just making sense about it. That's the second part. A third part would be I find it fulfilling and meaningful, and something about the people involved that strike me as being people that I think they are baridas and they've made.
If you can translate any.
Baridas means people who are sensible and made that decision. Those are a few of the things. Let's go back to the Mishalmi. Let's say you were dating a girl, but and it seems okay on what you've heard about her and you like her, but she's a pariah. Everybody else likes to keep her with a 10-foot pole away. You're also going to worry about that. You know, it's which one do you give more weight to? I'm not sure. It depends on the person. Different people give different parts the weight to, but all the pieces that fall into place. And that's why no amount of bull sessions should convince a person to become from. Experiencing it without having a reasonable, not word proof, but as much as a logical basis for it. Something that came out of thin air without any tradition which would tie it back to some event would be suspect. And when you have all the pieces together, then it makes sense. So I would say I see it as an artificial dichotomy, and just like real important life decisions we make based on many, many parts of our sensory systems falling into place, I would say the same about this.
Question number two. No, we're not doing follow-ups. I'm sorry. Question number two. Why is the Gemara so important to learn? The Mitzvah Talmud Torah is so much wider than that.
And you base that on what? In that second half of the sentence.
I don't want to ask the person to say it, but in other words, Torah is vast. There's Chumash, there's Halacha,
okay.
There's Midrashim, there's Kabbalah. Why okay. Do we have to spend all day learning Gemara?
Good. This question is asked by every boy that has when he starts learning Gemara, except in a yeshiva society, since it's in the air that they're giving so much emphasis, you never ask. You know, it's so brilliant, but it's a real good question. So the answer to that is the only place that has the only place that we're accountable to is the Gemara. Meaning as follows. The Chumash itself does not contain enough information to make any decisions on. There was a fellow who wrote a book. He followed the Bible for a year straight. I don't remember the name of it. It's definitely...
You're living biblically.
Yeah, okay. Now, it definitely makes... I haven't read it. It makes for an interesting read. I would call it born-again Karaite or something like that. But it makes for an interesting read. What does it mean, live in booths? Is it any booth? Is this? It doesn't, the Chumash itself does not contain the information that you really need to be kind of mitzvahs. If the Gemara works out the Torah Shabbat Ksav together with the Torah Shabbat Peh,
English,
yes, okay. The the Torah is the written law. The Talmud has incorporated in itself the basic oral law, which is the basic description of what we're talking about, and then arguments and discussions that give you some sense of a bigger picture of it. Now, you can halachically use a Gemara and be paskin a shaila. Is that English, paskin a shaila?
Yeah. We have some brand new guys here.
Okay, you can reach... in my dictionary, it's English with you know, ancient Aramaic roots. But you can actually... you can reach a decision. It's dangerous because there is just the Talmud is spread up all over the place, and you'd have to know all the information and be able to weigh it correctly. That's why we go to the next stage of the next few hundred years that have brought it down very piecemeal. But if a person bases his decisions on the Gemara, and that's the only one that pulls rank, we defer to greater scholars than us, and that's why nobody really would reach a solution not based on very contemporary great people and so on. But you can't say the person is wrong if he builds it on the Talmud. The Talmud is the last, I would sort of canonized work where it's absolute, it's binding. Everything afterwards is open to proof, discussion, counter-discussion. It's just that we kind of recognize where we are and we keep our position. We know exactly where we are. So, the Talmud is absolutely the determining work in halacha. Two, the same thing is also true in philosophy. The Talmud itself doesn't really speak in terms of philosophy or ethics even. I mean, they'll be also, but if you build any type of explanation, it has to include enough material that you can honestly say this is the Talmud's approach to these issues. You're standing on very, very skimpy ground if you don't. The third reason is kind of, didactically, all works that really go into the give and take use the Talmud and that style for teaching it and explaining it. If you don't have some basic knowledge of it, skills and so on, you're always kind of living, you know, it's a hand-me-down three times. And it's a terrible thing to go through life sort of blind and, well, this rabbi said this, that rabbi said that, and I'm not sure why he said this, not sure why he said that, and I don't know if he's right, if he's wrong, if he's an Epicurus, if he's an extremist. You don't have even a thread of a sense of the material itself. So getting a sense of how the Talmud works, the back and forth, the basic vocabulary, the basic ideas, would give you, it would make you part of the process instead of being a really nebbish outsider.
Sort of a follow-up to that, if a machlokus, which is an argument in a Gemara, for example, or a din, a law, is generated purely by the thinking of the humans involved, for example, the svara, or the conceptual thinking of a rishon, then are we really studying Torah when we study that? We're looking at the machlokus achronim and what Tosfos is saying, etc., etc. How can we say that's called really studying Torah?
So there's a piece in the Talmud that actually addresses it, and it's spoken of part of it. It says, I'll sort of paraphrase the way it says, it's built on a verse in Kohelet, and it goes along the lines of, well, you see so many rabbis disputing it, and you look and you ask yourself, how will I ever know the truth? And the answer is, they were all given from one shepherd in one place, etc. And the Talmud says all of the arguments and so on were given at Sinai. I want to explain that passage. The explanation I'm using is written by an early commentary, the Ran. I want to explain it. Torah, by definition, is the written Torah that God gave, the basic explanations that were given with it, and the reasonable points that may be made in discussing new issues or trying to reconstruct forgotten pieces. Those different pieces were intended to be there. If the logic you use is appropriate logic, it fits the Talmudic structure, and you honestly are attempting to get to the bottom of something, that's called Torah. If you made a blessing on the Torah in the morning, and instead of saying those few verses that you say afterwards, you immediately ran and started learning, saying and putting down your point. Even if you're outvoted, that's real Torah. The blessing is a good blessing because what you learned was Torah. Torah is the attempt to understand the written and basic oral law using reasonable points are all Torah. At the end of the day, we have to follow one opinion or the other, and we have rules for that. You go with a majority, you look at the caliber of people arguing, but it doesn't take away. And that's the Torah is the reasonable points, and this is let me give a sort of an example to understand the hierarchy. It's one of very difficult points. If it's wrong, how could it be Torah? And if it's let's say we're trying to build a bridge from, I don't know, high north to the old city, to the Kotel. Make it a very straight bridge. And you send out and you ask people for different suggestions. So you might get a whole bunch of very fascinating suggestions in terms of the route of the bridge, the support system, the structural issues, aesthetic issues. You might end up with 10, 15 different proposals. And you'll choose one based on cost, popularity, or whatever it is. They are all our bridges. They're all correctly labeled as bridges, even though you're going to stick with one of them for some other reason. Torah is broad enough intellectually to include opposing opinions that are valid opinions, that are of the fabric of the type of opinions that make sense within the Gemara, and even though to follow rulings, the Torah clamped down and said one and one only. I always use, in yeshiva, I use a mashal. It's simply because I puzzled over it when I was young. And that's why it stuck. When we learned algebra, simple algebra, so the question of what is the square root of 4 has two answers, 2 and minus 2. If you get one or the other, if you write one or the other, you get only either depending 50% credit or no credit, depending on how mean the teacher is. Or, if he's very nice, he'll sort of give a check and say, you could have got another one. But usually they were kind of very mean because they were always busy telling you that, that depending on the exponent, that's how many solutions there have to be, and so on and so forth. Now, there was a problem. A typical problem would go, a man had a square yard, and he bought fencing, and he bought tiles for it, and whatever it was 4 square feet of tiles. How big is each side? If you answered minus 2, you were wrong. And I remember puzzling over it. Well, it's right on this test, and it's wrong on this test. I mean, get your act together. Like, are both right answers or not right? How could it be? I put it into formula, solve it, and the solution is 2 or minus 2. And the answer is, math is hierarchically more abstract. In the world of men, 4 has 2 square roots. But when you talk about a field, you've taken it down and sort of limited. Fields don't have minus 2 as a side, unless today people are mortgaged and the field has much less. people can have fields worth, the more field you have, the less it's worth. So today we can see where the other solution comes in. But that other solution doesn't exist, not because on the level of math it exists, doesn't it? Halacha, which is the pure Torah, and psak, which is the how shall we apply to this world, are the same hierarchy. In the world of pure Torah, it recognizes Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel's opinion as both being valid. And they both have a point to make. In other words, looking at this way and looking at this way. In applying Torah to this real world, we need to cut and say, we can't have everyone doing it differently. And when we bring out this world, we pass like Beis Hillel. So on the higher level, it has more solutions. It's one of the reasons, by the way, why Kabbalah will say sometimes things that are not like halacha. The reason is Kabbalah is of a higher world. It's not we don't do like Kabbalah, but we understand that it has a truth. There is a truth to X, Y, and Z, but it's a truth that is not applied to the world here and now if it's in conflict with the halachic system. Yes.
Okay. Is the purpose of our existence to feel as close to Hashem as possible, or simply to do all the mitzvahs? Meaning, who is doing better? The person who feels very spiritual and strives to connect, or the person who does all the mitzvahs with precision but feels no spirituality or connection?
In a certain sense, this was a big bone of contention 200 years ago. Really, if you look at the Hasidic and the non-Hasidic or anti-Hasidic works, this seems to be that going back and forth. I am a believer that they weren't arguing on the point itself, but they were more arguing where they felt people were going with it. Let's start with what the Torah says. The Torah gives us certain mitzvahs that are very elementary and that are defined as emotional connections. You have ahava, which means a tremendous drive towards doing something. You're attracted by something. Ahava is, you know, we speak about ahava, it means we're drawn to something, and that obviously speaks. We speak about yira, which is awe, and we speak of simcha, which is a sense of profound accomplishment.
Simcha,
happiness, yes. But Ava and Yira, you let me get away with that. That was
Ava,
I said, is love. Yira is fear. And the Kuzari has a beautiful piece, really masterful piece, where he speaks about the three pillars of Judaism being love, awe, and happiness.
Happiness?
Listen, some mitzvahs require a lot of sacrifice to do, Rabbi Rosenblum, and I'm sure happiness is a very, very tough mitzvah, but there's a Hasidic joke about the non-Hasidim, that why is it that there are four verses read in the Megillah on Purim with the tune of Lamentations, of Eicha? And the answer is so that even the non-Hasidim would feel a little joy on Purim. So the question was, so why don't you read the entire Megillah with that tone? And the answer is, because to be too merry is really not good, and one should keep it in check. That was the, growing up in a society that was mixed with Hasidim and non-Hasidim, you get the jokes on both sides of the fence. But the Kuzari makes the point, we have a mitzvah, it says at the end of Kisavo in Deuteronomy, you have the reason why you're getting all these severe punishments is because you didn't worship God with happiness and joy of heart and so on. The verse has, it's a little bit up in the air. It could mean when things were going well, you didn't worship God. It's ambiguous, the language, or it could mean because you didn't, and many poskim feel it. That's what it means. So you definitely have these elements in it, and the Torah says there is the Zohar describes a person who does mitzvahs without love and fear. It's like a bird without wings. In other words, there's no spirit to it. It's not soaring up. It's not bringing it up, and so on. However, the other side was that it doesn't start because you're not doing it because you like it or because you enjoy it or because you feel fulfilled. You're obligated to do it no matter what. But having said that, you're obligated to think about it and understand it in a way that it brings a deep emotional satisfaction. So the emotional satisfaction is not the cause, but it is a very vital part of the picture. A person is unhappy because if we don't feel fulfilled by something we're doing, because we don't see its relevance, we don't see its importance. A kid is studying in school and he's usually dreading it because he doesn't feel that it's getting him any place, he's going to do anything with it. An adult who understands why he's doing it, and he's very happy with the work he's doing, and he sees it's going someplace. So the answer is, the motive behind it is, whether you like it or not, you're still obligated to do it. That's our very strong sense of God and right and wrong. But Hashem is not, what God wants out of us is not to do things despite us, ourselves. He wanted it for our good, and you don't have, if you're doing it and you're not happy with it, you're not fulfilled with it, then you're missing the neshama of it. Putting the neshama into it is part of what Hashem wants out of it. It requires thinking about it, it requires contemplating it, and so on. But at the end of the day, that's part of what we're supposed to do.
A bit of a follow-up on this, and maybe you already answered that.
How did they know what to follow up?
It's coming from somewhere. There are certain nuances of Shabbat, like not separating the bone from the chicken, pulling
right.
the bone out, but yes, taking the chicken off the bone, that if anything, tend to take away from the spirit of Shabbat. Question mark.
Well, okay. There's an old Jewish joke. I grew up, my parents were survivors and they spoke Yiddish, and my culture was kind of very old-time Yiddish, that a young American yuppie took his old European father to a violin concert, and he explained to him the chivas of it, you know, it's Lincoln's, you've made it, and it's the best, and so on. And the father's sitting there, and he's looking very intently at what's going on, and sort of, as all Jews, knows immediately what's happening, and puts his take on it. Comes home, he says, you know, I followed the man very carefully. Now, when he was going like this, that really is meaningful. But this part was a shtick to impress everybody. This part doesn't do anything. This part is really impressive. This is not part. It's hard. You're right. As an outsider sitting at a... If we're coming in as an outsider and you look at it, it you know, some parts of it appeal immediately. Some parts of it, you can figure out. Some parts do look like the kind of nitpicking and so on. But like we spoke about studying the Talmud, when you start getting the whole sense of it, then it makes sense in that context. If we were able to move a few steps forward and see Shabbos means a person stops creating and starts enjoying. A person stops doing things in the world and pauses to take note of the world he's done. And a person outlines what are the basic creative activities. Separating things, in other words, grouping, separating, is a very important part of what we do in this world. That the Gemara says a person, a minimal test of maturity or intelligence of a child is the ability to separate useful stuff from not useful stuff. The language in the Talmud is nuts that are edible from leaves and stuff that are not edible. The sense of a person being able to separate things is that, and we enact it by, you know, by doing these things. And as it's just like a person, you know, just to go back to the violin marshal, when you're studying art, before you study art and you see all sorts of paintings, some of it is immediately appealing, some of it you don't understand what it's there for, it doesn't seem to be serving a purpose, and as somebody begins to point out to you the effect that certain things have, the subtle effects, so on and so forth, it takes on the picture becomes clearer. So the answer is, that's why it's important to try to get it from as original source as possible, to identify with the system a lot more than just with the appearance or the projection of it.
Shifting gears, I've heard women shouldn't have public roles, but there were female prophets. Devorah was a leader. What happened? What changed?
Well, prophet is an easy one because God chooses the prophet. If a woman comes along and says, "I am a prophet," and proves it, then, I mean, if God sent her, we're not going to, you know, that's not going. What?
Let's try to argue.
Matt, you can argue with it has been people in the past generation who have stepped forth. I mean, Sarah Schneerer, who founded the Beis Yaakov system, did it. Created something that no one else had done. She's a real hero. Probably, there's a famous story where somebody said that all of Torah is due to her, because if there wouldn't be women who had the same ideals, shared those ideals of Torah, there wouldn't be any a Torah world today. And she did it single-handedly. There was opposition. And yet, what's interesting about it is, once she started a project, everyone fell in and felt it was sincere and was good. At the end of the day, there are certain things that are done that require... people need to get a sense that you're not pushing an agenda. The traditional role for most women is not public. It's part of our sense of tznius, part of our sense of kolkura v'svachpim, and so on. The exceptions have somehow surfaced. And there have been women over the ages who've been scholarly. They've quoted, actually, even Shacharach in one or two places, not in Shacharach itself, but the Sma quotes and so on. They're always kind of recognized post facto, sort of. Yes, people have a sense that this person is sincere and this person is right. And, you know, we will fall in and close ranks. But certainly not as the way we raise our daughters and so on. That's the only answer I can give them.
How do cooking and cleaning develop any human's potentials? By contrast, learning Torah is spoken of as directly bringing people to fulfillment and greatness. How are women supposed to get that without studying Torah?
Let me use a kind of a mushal and an analogy of sorts. I'm not particularly details don't mean much to me and so on. Not my thing. And I was a bacher in a dormitory, and my room looked like a dormitory room. And it was the normal bacher eating and so on and so forth. I once picked up a piece of newspaper. And I was very into what do you need this thing for? Nothing has to be fancy and everything could be, I had that some mentality. I once picked up a piece of newspaper, I guess I was very bored, and it was a Frum newspaper, and this happened to be the cooking section. You really have to be bored, but I don't know why it caught my eye, and it said how to prepare Sheva Brachas, like without overdoing it. I don't remember the details, though the writer will forgive me if I've changed some of it, but basically it was something like this. You don't need to make yourself crazy and work hard and spend a lot of money for Sheva Brachas. It's fine if you open up a can of peas. It's fine if you open up a can of this. You need only to cook one thing, and it can be the chicken that's from Shabbos and sort of redone again and as a goulash or whatever it is. And for dessert, why don't you cut up a watermelon? Why don't you take out a big box of biscuitim and so on? That was the more or less. And I said to myself, what statement do you make to the person when that's what you serve? The answer is, I really don't want to do it, but it's a mitzvah and I got to do it. So let's get it over with as cheaply and as painlessly as possible. That's basic. When you come home, I mean, Baruch Hashem, I've married 37 years. You come home from a long, hard day, and what greets you is warmth. A hot meal is not the same as what you buy out. It's somebody sat and cooked it and did it for you. And somebody takes pleasure in the fact that it's enjoyable, it's different, it's not the same as yesterday's. There's a variety of aromas, there's a variety of colors. There's a cleanliness, there's a warmth. Those things speak volumes of emotions, care, and kids who grow up in institutions, the most best-run institutions, are crippled children because you don't have it. Someone told me a fascinating story from a gadol. I had a friend of mine who ran...
A gadol?
A gadol is a big person, a big... Talmud Chacham. A great man. The truth is, the story would even lose somebody edge of it, not understanding the ascetic type of Talmud Chacham, saying, so my friend ran the facility for yeshiva, took care of, you know, that the plant and so on, and he figured out that they have not many kids at the yeshiva. It would be much cheaper to buy it. So he went to Reb Shmuel Auerbach, who I think he was the head of it, and he said, listen, I've just figured out the cost. It's much more cost effective to simply order it, and that's it. And he told him, he looked at him and said, you're right, but when kids smell onions being fried, it creates a certain environment. And I want to keep a kitchen aroma in the yeshiva because it's important for the kids. Maybe the younger kids a little bit. If living at home, where the home environment is simply meals brought in or going out and so on, a woman when she's preparing a meal and keeping things, you can tell a woman's moods. If a woman is down, the house will reflect it, the meals will reflect it. If a woman is up, the house will affect the meals, what she wears. They are not... they are very, very significant. Yes, as men, we have less of a sense of it in doing it, but we sure appreciate it. I had a neighbor, we're both parents. We're very successful career people, very good people, but the mother never, ever did anything in the house. They had that money, and they would buy out, and whatever it is, they make do. And the kids, their oldest son is getting married, he said, I want a wife. I've eaten corn out of a can long enough, and I want a home. And those are things that are... And it's one of the things that I speak to. It's a very idealistic young men and women when they come before getting married, sometimes in yeshiva, and we speak about it. And I tell... For girls, there's this paradigm shift, because in school, they're kind of given the idea that going to a lot of shiurim is important and doing this important. They're wonderful things. But a woman sets a tone at home with the atmosphere she creates. And I think it says volumes. I want to tell you, there was a woman who lived in Meir Sharim, Rebbetzin Brim. And it was Rabbi in Rebbetzin Brim. He was a tremendous scholar and a very big person. He was a student of the Chazon Ish and also by Chassidish Yichas. And he used to have a very strong... he had a lot to do with the Meir Yeshiva. He would give different. He would teach groups of boys in his house. And his wife was the daughter of a very great Rav, and she was an extraordinary woman. They lived in 1.5 rooms in Meir Sharim, the old time Meir Sharim house, a big front room and a small master bedroom and a small kitchen. The house was always well done. It was nice. It was pleasant. Aesthetically, it was always painted every year, and, you know, everything was taken care of. And my wife, the last year or two that we lived here, she made it a point to visit her almost every day because she liked this woman's company. She felt that it was giving her a lot. And it was also very close to her mother's house, so she would go from her mother's house and stop off for a visit by her. And unfailingly, if she came around lunchtime, the first question was to my wife, Yaffa, what did you prepare for the meal today? And there was a message there. It's nice that we're talking, and it's wonderful. Divrei Torah, fine and good. What did you prepare for a meal? That's how you express, all those feelings are expressed that way. And it's a very, it's significant. And anyone who's fortunate enough to have grown up that way knows that that's, you know, that gives it. And that so I don't buy the belittling aspect of it. So.
How do you justify spending an hour and a half davening every day when you can't know what the effect is on this world, and you can spend the time helping the world in ways that have reliable and measurable results instead?
I guess it's a broader topic. The one who discusses it very interestingly is Rav Volba in his second volume. He speaks about reaching out. And it's something in yeshivas traditionally, the first years of development, meaning like ages 18, 19, 20, until 22, 23 for sure, are very inward focused. And if we participated in any outside activity, whether it was helping someone spreading Judaism, rioting, an important burning of a trash can or something. Whatever we did, we got it over the head for not being in yeshiva. And I would wonder about it. And then I realized, listen, it is important. But in a person's development, when is a person helping somebody else and when is he a busybody? When is it durable? When is it teenage exuberance? What happened? I grew up in the 60s. And in the 60s, not my generation, they were a little older than me. They were turning the world upside down, exposing all the evils of the world, and calling for a just and good society. And they had some very good points. The hippie movement has some great points. What happened to all the leaders of the hippie movement? So those who are not dead of overdosing, or who didn't fry their brains out with LSD, they had a study. Most of them are high-powered traders of Wall Street. They had all the pictures. It was amazing. 25 years down the line, they were the enemy. And the answer is because it wasn't a focused working stuff. It was an exuberance of emotions, which is fine, but it's not something. A person's goodness needs to be real goodness coming with commitment and so on. And when a person stands and davens, he's making a statement. There is a God, and it's what he wants in this world, and I am humble, and I can't do everything, and I have to do what's right, and I need to ask for the ability and the sense to do it right, and so on. That's the Aleph base. Without that, it's the difference between a slow-burning fire, which can do a lot of good, to an explosion, which just, it's a magnificent explosion, but that's all it is. Most people who go on helping, it's sort of, it peters out, and sometimes just becomes even, what's happened to the movement now, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Washington, and so on. It's fun, it's interesting. It's not that they don't have some points, but there's nothing more than that. It's not going anyplace because people are still animals. You need to develop yourself, and then the goodness to others need to be a real outcome of a good self. That's the point of it.
How do we approach historical scientific information or truths that seem to conflict with religion?
With caution. The truth is. Let me tell you a paradigm that I like to use as a focal point. Tosfos, the Talmud discusses what is considered circular in halacha. What's considered circular? And the Talmud puts down a 3-to-1 ratio as being a circle. Tosfos asks on it. Tosfos is a medieval commentary from France. It's actually not one commentary. It's a whole school of commentaries put together. And it's sort of the most significant dialectic on the Talmud as opposed to Rashi, which is a running commentary. He asks, well, that's not true. A circle is not 3 times to 1. It's, he doesn't give them the exact number, but and Tosfos leaves it at a question. There will be every so often an issue. I don't need to word science history. It's a fact. In other words, science and history is valid not because authority is called in, it's simply because that's what it is. So at that point, we can go from two extremes. We can either say science hasn't settled it out completely yet, and my feeling is it'll settle out differently. It can have a different explanation than is given. And most of the time, you're talking about an explanation rather than a straight-out fact. Or you could say the pshat must have some tweak to it. For instance, this piece over here, there are actually some very good pshatim for it. Very simple ones that are logical. The Talmud is simply telling me halachic parameter, legal definitions rather than the pure fact, which is fine. But in either case, a person need not to be scared of leaving things as a problem and to work at it. I was just now reading a book. I happened to pick up now. It's in Hebrew. I don't think it's translated. Two Israeli archaeologists, Levy and somebody else, have presented a thesis on biblical archaeology, which I don't have the expertise to evaluate it, but it's stunning. They've claimed, they show how archaeological evidence is out of sync with biblical evidence. And then they say, because they're dating it wrong, let's shift over Yetzias Mitzrayim instead of being at this time pharaoh was this pharaoh, and everything fits in amazingly well. Amazingly, not only that, every piece of it, it's almost as if it's like you align the pieces and it's perfect. Now, I don't have the ability to tell you how great this is or how offbeat it is. I don't know. I really don't know. But it's a type of thing where people have to understand, when you're not talking about facts in front of your eyes, when you're talking about anything of history, evolution, you're talking about creating a story out of relics, out of bits and pieces. The same thing is true about evolution, same thing is true about archaeological history. It's never, ever... the Torah can't contradict a fact head on, but very rarely is it the facts are being contradicted. It's usually where the evidence leads you to be, and that's something that. So, first thing is, don't be scared of a question. I have a cousin of mine who's a physicist, big physicist. He unfortunately worked for Lucent, so all of his retirement went down. But he's a Baal Tshuva. He became frum as a young man and was close in age, very, very special person. And he told us some long time ago, he was visiting us, and he told us some issues with a current way of thinking in physics, nothing to do with Torah. So my brother asked him, so why don't you discard the theory? And he said, there are 10,000 scenarios. 9,945 work and 55 don't. We're not about to discard it. It takes a lot more to upset something that works so well in so many different places. We'd rather think, if your amuna is based on one question, one answer, then it takes one question to dislodge it. Hopefully, like we started in the beginning, it's a much bigger picture, and therefore you're going to... okay, it's an issue. Sometimes I'll never find an answer that's really satisfying. It's kind of okay, maybe. Or someday they'll click it. It's never. I need to go soon. What time we have to leave? Like soon? Call a cab or whatever. Fine. Okay. So maybe call a cab now. We'll take one more question or whatever. Yeah. Until he tells me the cab came. Until yeah. It's not going to help because I have to get there at 1:45. So
how can we?
I'm going to have a lot of questions to answer.
What time you need to be there, by the way?
9:45.
Shouldn't take you more than 15 minutes to get there.
Really? Okay. So what's that?
Rosenblum, is that correct? Red Rosenblum.
Where are you going?
To Telstone to Yisrael Leif.
Can I go with you?
Good question.
Seriously, is it more than 15 minutes?
I could do it in 5. It takes about. 18 minutes.
Okay, so
how can we state the existence of infinity while we ourselves exist as limited, finite, and non-perfect beings living in a world shaped by form and within time, elements that are all contradictory to the concept of infinity itself?
What?
Okay.
Can you
say that again?
It's a very good question. Let me explain. We only get to infinity, our concept like infinity, which is meaningless to us, by saying that the finite is something that can't exist by itself. In other words, when nothing is the default setting, which is what we logically assume to be correct, if we walk into a room that has, let's say nothing was here, there were no farm shelves, no table, there's nothing. And when they first came to look at this place, they saw nothing. No one asks, why is there nothing here? The question is, why is there a table? Why are there chairs? Okay, so this guy brought tables, this guy brought chairs, so on and so forth. So things creating themselves there is, you can use language as fancy as you want, as many equations as you want. It's something that tells us an impossibility. And the only solution to that impossibility is that something exists that doesn't fit into the box of our brain. At its widest, no matter how wide we're going to stretch our brain, the reality we can recognize. It's like when you see the tip of an iceberg. I only see the tip of it, but icebergs don't come only in tips. The tip has to be standing on something that reaches down to the bottom of the ocean or whatever it is. So when we throw around a word like infinite, it's a realization that within boundaries, it's self-contradictory. And that which is bounded could never have existed. So we have a sense of things are bounded, and that's real to us, and that's where our intelligence functions. That's fine. But this must be the tip of an iceberg. So basically we sort of extrapolate outwards and we say, this must be the tip of the iceberg, and what is beyond that is not definable, it has no ability to be boxed into our box. That's about it.
Should everyone raise their kids with the goal of being Talmid Chachamim? Is that sustainable?
You mean Talmid Chachamim as people who don't work or do anything else?
Yes.
I would put it on two levels. First of all, there's one thing about worrying about the world in general. In other words, if we all raise our kids to be sitting alone as that, I think there's one issue of, is it right to push someone whose abilities and talents and affinity lies somewhere else to do full-time learning? I would worry that much more. And I would say the answer is, once upon a time, I think it was critical, when nobody was learning, there was no Keter Talmid Chacham, nothing existed. Not long ago, 50, 60 years ago, no one knew anything. The world was dark in that way. And once we have a large enough group of Talmid Chachamim, and everyone else being knowledgeable and being connected, so the next thing should be, what's good for each person? Each person has to sustain himself financially. Each person has talents that he needs to use in a certain way. Each person has emotional needs. Some people can sit by a safer all day. Some people will go out of their minds. Some people need to do. Some people need to shape. Everyone is different. And I think this is a stage now where the right thing is to have each person find his place. And sometimes it's tricky, sometimes it's not easy to figure out, but at least I think that before we worry even about the macro picture, I think each individual. And at our yeshiva, that's what we do.
Okay. If a person could be a successful businessman or a successful Talmid Chacham, does he have an obligation to become a Talmid Chacham instead?
It really depends on... There's a Sefer Chassidim that says if a person has the ability to support many others, then he should go into the business and so on. It really depends. Listen, if a person can do both equally well, really, which is not usual because it's very different set of emotional and mental composition, then it's a choice, and he has to make the choice. It should come out of a sense of ideal and nobility, never because he's ashamed to do the other. It's contrary to the way the world is. It requires, like the Rambam says, somebody elevating himself. And, you know, it's something which he has to be inspired to do that. So a person, well, this is equally well for him, he has to feel inspired, and like the Rambam says, if his spirit raised him and he decided to be beyond the world's norms, then it's doable.
Is sneus, which this person is defining as not attracting public attention,
right,
equally important for males and females?
It's equally important, but express itself differently. Generally speaking, females are attractive to men, and that's why there is an emphasis on the physical part, whereas in a male sense, it's a lot more about the showy trappings and stuff like that, and it's less defined. In women, the component of physical attraction is very strong, and therefore that has to... Okay, I'm sorry, I have to go. I didn't want to interrupt you, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much.